He was standing in front of his assistant's desk in the waiting area that his office shared with his deputies on the opposite side. I knew from Andy's terse comments on the phone that what he was saying was not really up for debate, nor did I expect him to offer any additional information about the president's telephone discussion with the vice president. To this day, I do not know what the two discussed. I'm confident from knowing the president and from our previous conversations that he did not have any knowledge about Libby, Rove, or anyone else involved in disclosing Plame's identity to reporters. President Bush would not have deliberately misled me. While I wish I could say the same about the vice president, I simply don't know for sure. Information that would become public in future legal proceedings would raise questions about the vice president's actions that he has never publicly addressed. I told Andy I would make the same public statement about Scooter as I had for Carl, provided I received the same assurance from Scooter. Andy asked what statement I had given about Carl, and I told him I had said he was neither involved in leaking Plame's identity, nor did he condone it. I told Andy that once I'd spoken with Scooter, I would call a few reporters to make sure it got out. When I got back to my office, I called a White House operator to track down Scooter. As he often did, he was traveling with Cheney, who was spending the weekend at his place in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. The conversation was short. Scooter was never one for many words anyway. He knew why I was calling, since he had instigated what I was being instructed to do. "Were you involved in the leak in any way?" I asked him. "No, absolutely not," Scooter replied. "All right," I said. "I plan to tell reporters that you did not leak the classified information, nor would you condone doing so. Is that correct?" "Yes," he replied. Then we talked about which reporters I planned to call. Scooter hung up, and I set about my disagreeable task. I called reporters for Newsweek, which I'd heard was working on a story focusing on Scooter, the AP, and the New York Times. That same day, I happened to run into Washington Post correspondent Mike Allen outside on the White House grounds, and I told him as well. That made four reporters from four top national media organizations, plenty to get the news out, especially with it getting on the AP wire for all media to see. I told each that Scooter had assured me he neither leaked the classified information nor would he condone it, and made sure the press duty officer for the day was aware so as not to be caught blindsided if other media outlets called seeking to match their competitors. Sure enough, pretty soon it was on the Associated Press newswire as part of a larger story on the leak investigation. I was glad to see it handled that way. It meant I'd managed to get the news about my official defense of Scooter out without drawing too much extra attention to it. A short time later, I learned from Sean McCormick, another of my deputies and the chief spokesman for the National Security Council, that Elliot Abrams, a senior National Security Council staffer, had denied any involvement to a reporter who had contacted him directly because of rumors. It's a sadly typical tactic used by some of the less scrupulous partisan activists in Washington during a time of scandal. Float a rumor in the media and see if it sticks. There was zero information to suggest Elliot was involved in the disclosure of Plame's identity, but he was considered a leading neoconservative foreign policy hawk and was an early advocate of regime change in Iraq. He'd also been pardoned by the first President Bush for two misdemeanor pleas for withholding information from Congress during the infamous Iran-Contra scandal. For these reasons, he was always an easy target for unsubstantiated allegations. As far as I was concerned, Elliot was a seasoned foreign policy expert and helpful colleague who always shot straight with me, including that day. I contacted him and got the same assurances, and thought I'd better go ahead and get his denials out to the same reporters I'd spoken to about Scooter, since Elliot had already spoken to one anyway. Better to get it all out at once in the same news cycle, as opposed to one today, one tomorrow, and so on. So I called the same reporters back. I was becoming increasingly frustrated, as this was exactly what I didn't want to happen. I was putting myself in the middle of the investigation by publicly vouching for people, against my own wishes, and against the sound advice of White House counsel. The following week, the press questions were back to the usual wide range of topics in the gaggles and briefings, but the leak investigation remained in the mix. Meanwhile, White House aides, including me, each in his or her own way, were sorting through their electronic records, correspondence, telephone logs, calendars, and notes, and then copying anything that might be relevant under the broadly encompassing specifications of the Justice Department request. On Monday, In response to follow-up questions, I confirmed at the briefing that I had spoken with Carl, Scooter, and Elliot, and that each had denied any involvement in the leaking of Plame's identity. As I'd suspected they would, reporters wondered why I'd questioned these three particular staff members and why the president was not demanding that other staff members be asked the same question. I did some verbal dancing in response, knowing I was not authorized to get into the full backstory. In hindsight, the president should have overruled his advisors and demanded that an internal investigation be conducted to determine whether there might have been any White House involvement. He also should have ordered the public release of as much information as possible as soon as it was known, so that the scandal would not take on a life of its own. But he chose not to do so, perhaps feeling that keeping clear of the story would insulate him and protect him from potential political damage. Instead, it gave the story broader and longer life, only helping to reinforce the permanent state of suspicion and partisan warfare he had pledged to move Washington beyond. Dan Bartlett later shared with me that David Addington, the vice president's counsel, had expressed concern after learning that I had publicly exonerated Scooter. Addington specifically warned Bartlett that I should not be out there talking about the investigation or discussing what anyone had done or not done. Bartlett responded, "It was your boss who told us to." I grimaced ever so briefly as Dan and I shook our heads. We were a bit incredulous. Addington is publicly perceived as one of the most secretive officials in the White House. Over time, however, I would find that he was also one of the most helpful to me. He shared information or advice privately so that I would not misstep publicly as press secretary. Nothing was more important to me than getting the full picture when seeking information from a colleague. It was not always easy in a White House where some cared little for the press or viewed it as another special interest. But David was considerate of my need to be fully briefed on things in order to be effective and accurate. If he knew something he felt would help, he did not need prompting to share it or a game of 20 questions to guess it. Unfortunately, Addington's advice was apparently neither heard nor heeded by those pushing me further into the abyss I had already unwittingly stepped into. At the Friday, October 10th briefing, I made my final comments about Rove's and Libby's assurances. Soon, FBI agents and Justice Department prosecutors would begin interviewing White House officials. I talked with Alan David about my personal situation after being contacted by the FBI. After reminding me that neither he nor Al was my personal attorney, David remarked, "This is not like being the White House spokesman. You want to answer questions completely and openly, as opposed to only the limited information you might share as a spokesman. You don't necessarily have to volunteer information beyond what they ask, but you need to be candid and responsive to what they do ask." The advice came as no surprise, but it was helpful to have it reinforced beforehand. Alan David also offered to provide someone from their office to sit in on any conversations I might have with the FBI. I realized this would also be a convenient way for them to keep tabs on the investigation and any possible fallout for the president. Nevertheless, I was glad to take them up on their offer. Within days, I had my first meeting with FBI agents in a second-floor conference room the counsel's office had set aside in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building on the White House grounds, just across the West Executive driveway from the West Wing staff entrance. The high-ceilinged room was lit by large windows on one side. Other than that, there was just a large wooden conference table surrounded by leather chairs. John Eckenrode, the special agent in charge of the investigation for the FBI from day one, led the discussion. He was joined by two other agents who were seated on the side of the table facing the door. I was on the other side, facing the windows behind them. They had been provided copies of all the documents from my work files that I had turned over to the counsel's office the second week in October. I remember one email I'd handed over from a friend of my personal assistant, Carmen Ingwell. Carmen's friend had attended a class or lecture event at a California university a few years earlier featuring Joe Wilson, during which, she said, Wilson had mentioned that his wife worked for the CIA. I had no idea whether the story was true or not. It was early in the investigation, and the agents seemed to be focused on learning about how the White House, including the White House communications team, operated and interacted with the media. Ted Ulliott, a smart, capable, 30-something attorney in the White House counsel's office, listened in as I answered questions. I already knew Teddy Little from working with him on other issues, and he had always come across as open and helpful. He and his colleague Raul Yanes had been tasked as the point people for the investigation in the counsel's office. I came to know Ted and Raul better during that time, and I thought that Al and David could not have chosen two finer individuals for such a controversial, high-profile task.